Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, St. Thomas Aquinas, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 6.
In his treatise on creation, Thomas begins with this question-like proposition. Whether it's necessary that every being be created by God? The proposition is followed by several objections. The first of them has relevance for us today. The objector throws out this challenge.
It would seem that it is not necessary that every being be created by God. For there is nothing to prevent a thing from being without that which does not belong to its essence, as someone can be human without being white. But the relation of the thing caused to its cause does not appear to be of the very essence of beings. For some beings can be understood without that relation. Therefore, they can exist without it. And hence, it is possible that some beings should not be created by God.
The objection argues that in order to know about things, we don't need to know about God and his creative causality. All we need to know are the things themselves. This objection says that instead of opening knowledge up to an infinite and mysterious ocean of substance, we can keep knowledge within the formal boundaries of things and avoid their deeper ontological roots, if they do in fact have any. We've already seen this cast of mind, which in our day has taken the name of positivism. In reply, Thomas concedes that at a certain level we can know things on their own terms. He agrees we can arrive at suitable descriptions or definitions of all things, but this knowledge is incomplete, he says, since what a thing is involves the cause of its being just as much as it involves its definition and properties. So to completely know things, we must inquire into their deepest origin.
It must be said that everything that in any way is from God. For whatever is found in anything by participation must be caused in it by that to which it belongs essentially. God is self-subsisting being itself, and subsisting being can be only one. Therefore, all beings other than God are not their own being, but are beings by participation. What is greatest in being, and greatest in truth, is the cause of every being and of every truth.
Having concluded that every being must be caused by God, we may be surprised to find the next article asking whether primary matter is created by God. Surely Thomas has already answered this in the previous topic, but a little thinking shows that this is not so. Every created being is, for Thomas, a composite. But primary matter is pure and unformed. Primary matter is the potentiality to form, and so it's a simple component of certain kinds of composites. Primary matter is not itself a composite. Now, some philosophers have held that unformed matter has existed throughout eternity. It's the pure potentiality used by God in forming things. This is similar to the modern view that the world about us has emerged from a chaotic swirl of atomic matter that's existed forever. We've already seen Thomas's position regarding the eternity of the world, but what is strictly at issue is not whether the world is eternal, but whether there is anything that is uncreated other than God. Prime matter isn't much. It isn't actual. It's merely potential. Yet that's too much for Thomas. For him, absolutely nothing is independent of God's creative power. For his dialogue on creation, the objectors have other arrows in their quivers. One emphasizes the differences between gods and creatures. The objector puts the case.
It would seem that primary matter is not created by God. For whatever is made is composed of a subject and of something else. But primary matter has no subject. Therefore, primary matter cannot have been made by God.
Thomas concedes that when we consider the familiar changes around us, we think of an existing object that then undergoes change. Indeed, Aristotle had even described a pre-existing substrate that undergoes change. But when we speak of creation, we speak of a kind of coming into being that has no preceding state. Creation does not presuppose an existing subject waiting in the wings to receive being. Before a being is created, it's nothing at all. Indeed, it's not too much to say that before the world was created, whether from eternity or not, it was not possible for the world to be. A second objector still denies that matter is made by God, borrowing Thomas's own characterization of God as pure act.
Activity and passivity are opposite members of a division. But just as the first active principle is God, so the first passive principle is matter. Therefore, God and primary matter are two principles divided against each other, neither of which is derived from the other.
And so the objector protests that something does escape God's creative power and will. Here we come to the crucial issue. In his solution, Thomas takes us through a brief lesson in the history of philosophy. It's drawn mostly from Aristotle's Metaphysics, but it goes beyond that great philosopher. As he looks back over the progress of philosophy, Thomas identifies three major stages in the philosopher's struggle to know the truth about things. What's at issue is the nature of being and what it means to come to be. In philosophy's first stage, which corresponds to the Greek philosophers before Plato and Aristotle, Thomas notes that the materialists were dominant.
At first, being rather undeveloped, they failed to realize that any beings existed other than sensible bodies.
Some early philosophers, like Parmenides, had denied that any being comes to be. Being is being, and that's that. Others, such as Heraclitus and Empedocles, had admitted that things come into being, but they'd pictured movement and becoming in purely physical terms. Following Aristotle, Thomas recapitulates the development of early thought.
The ancient philosophers gradually, and as it were, step by step, advanced in the knowledge of truth. At first, being rather undeveloped, they failed to realize that any beings existed except sensible bodies. And those among them who admitted movement did not consider it except according to certain accidents. For instance, according to rarefaction and condensation.
All of these early philosophers supposed the universe to be an uncreated material substance which takes on different shapes and qualities. And they believed that only physical forces altered that universe. A second stage of philosophical thinking was reached by Plato and Aristotle. Plato's theory of ideas or forms became the basis for the way things are. Each thing comes to be by participating in one or more forms. Being was no longer identified with what is material and sensible, but with various kinds of things. To the question, what is it for a thing to be? Plato and Aristotle answered, it's to be a certain kind of thing. It's to be an instance of one or another type. To come to know things, we need to classify them according to what they are. In Thomas's words,
an advance was made when Plato and Aristotle understood that there was a distinction between the substantial form, which determines what the thing is, and matter, which constricts the form to an individual. They held matter to be uncreated, and they posited certain universal causes for the change in things.
These first two stages of philosophy prepared the way for the third. Looking back to the first two stages, Thomas finds that they've kept being under wraps. The way they considered being was too restricted. Philosophers in the first stage saw being as this or that state of affairs, hot or cold, large or small. Philosophers in the second stage saw being as this or that specific sort of thing, animal, vegetal, inorganic, and other such classifications.
Each of these opinions, therefore, considered being under some specific or particular aspect, namely, either as this thing of a certain sort, or as a thing in one condition or another. And so, too, they assigned particular causes to the production of things.
Thomas believes his own work is the third stage of philosophical development. He puts forward what is, in truth, his own position with the modest words, then others advanced further. Thomas develops certain suggestions that he finds in the work of some Arabic and Jewish philosophers, such as Avicenna and Moses Maimonides. Of course, he's certainly aware of the biblical texts on creation and of the early Christian notion that creation was ex nihilo, out of nothing. But he ratifies this insight with a proper philosophical expression.
Others advanced further and raised themselves to the consideration of being as being. And they assigned a cause to things, not only according as they are things of this or that kind, or things in this or that condition, but according as they are beings.
At last, coming to be has itself come to be. Or rather, being and coming to be have been recognized at this third stage of philosophy. The cause of becoming has been proportionate to the understanding of reality at each stage. In the third stage, Thomas recognizes being in its absolute character. It's no longer under material and formal wraps. He can now say why we come to be, not in terms of material conditions or formal archetypes, but in terms of being itself. He continues,
therefore, whatever is the cause of things considered as beings must be the cause of things, not only according as they are made particular by accidental forms, nor according as they are made to be this or that sort of thing by substantial forms, but also according to all that belongs to their being, in any way whatever.
Since prime matter is a component of material things, it too must be created as part of the things themselves. And it must be created by the pure being who causes all being, and whose proper effect is the being of things. This view remains true if the world has always existed, and it remains true if, as the Christian faith holds, it has not. After describing his view of creation, Thomas passes on to what he calls the Treatise on Angels. This treatise earned him the nickname the Angelic Doctor. No one had ever written so extensively and so clearly about pure spirits and first creatures. The concept of angels is another matter beyond the boundaries of philosophy, so we pass it by. But we should note how densely populated the universe is, at least as Thomas sees it. Between man and God, there are countless hierarchies of angelic beings giving glory to God. There are also the angels' dark counterparts, what the Bible calls principalities and powers, which work against God's intention. In his work on creation, Thomas takes up certain theological questions regarding the work of the six biblical days of creation. After this short section comes his treatise on man, which was to have an important and enduring influence in philosophical history. Before we turn to the treatise on man, though, we should mention Thomas's notion of image. That's a distinctive relation that serves as the bridge between man and God. And this notion of image plays an important role in his thoughts on providence or divine government. Thomas examines the scriptural adage that human beings are made in the image of God. This confirms his philosophical reasoning because it follows from the philosophical conclusion that God is the cause of man. This idea also follows from the philosophical maxim that every cause produces a likeness in the effect. Even though we've learned that the likeness may be a very remote one, Thomas asks whether the image of God is in man. His answer qualifies the ordinary meaning of the word image.
It is clear that the notion of likeness is essential to the notion of image, and that an image adds something to likeness, namely that it is copied from something else. For an image is so called because it is produced as an imitation of something else. And so an egg, however much like and equal to another egg, is not called an image of the other egg because it is not copied from it. But equality does not belong to the essence of an image, as we see in a person's image reflected in a glass. Yet equality is of the essence of a perfect image, for in a perfect image nothing is wanting that is to be found in that of which it is a copy. Now, it is manifest that in man there is some likeness to God, copied from God as from an exemplar. Yet this likeness is not one of equality, for such an exemplar infinitely excels its copy. Therefore, there is in man a likeness of God, not indeed a perfect likeness, but imperfect. And Scripture signifies the same thing, when it says that man was made to God's likeness. For the preposition to signifies a certain approach, as of something at a distance.
Thomas further refines this concept of image in the next article, noting three different ways that a thing can be like God.
Some things are like God, first and most commonly, because they exist. Secondly, because they live. And thirdly, because they know or understand. These last, as Augustine says, approach so near to God in likeness that among all creatures, nothing comes nearer to him.
In his prologue to the second part of the Summa, Thomas tells us that God's image in man consists in man's free will.
Each person has understanding, free will, and command of himself. Following upon what has been said about God, who is the exemplar or model, and what has been said about the created things, which have come about through the free use of the divine power, it remains to consider God's image, that is to say, the human being, insofar as he is himself the source of his acts, having free will and power over his own actions.
We realize ourselves as persons, above all through appropriate activity. As we work and live with the actuality that is God, we become more God-like. At the same time, we define and shape ourselves.
What is particular and individual is found in a special and more complete way in rational substances, for they have dominion over their own actions. They are not only acted upon, as are other substances, but they act out of themselves. Now, it is proper to individuals to act. And so, among the various substances, a special name is given to individuals who possess a rational nature, and this name is person.
As Thomas turns to the nature of man, the angelic doctor knows full well that a human being is not an angel. Still, he believes the human soul is not merely a visitor to this planet. On the contrary, the soul is intimately present everywhere in the body as its home. More precisely, Thomas believes the body is taken up into the soul. By Thomas's time, the 13th century, Christians had drawn inspiration for over 1,000 years from Plato's teaching about the human soul. In grasping the soul's spiritual character, Plato had seemed almost to make it a sort of visitor, residing for a time in the body. Like the philosopher who returns to the cave in Plato's famous metaphor, the soul enters the body to arrange things for the body's good. After this long tradition of Platonism, perhaps nothing disturbed 13th century Christians more than the new ideas spawned by Aristotle's rediscovered works. The most upsetting idea of all was the way Aristotle bound the human soul so closely to the body. This seemed to threaten the cherished Christian concept of the immortal separate soul. Indeed, Aristotle's ambiguous views in this vital question of the soul had created controversy among his Latin followers. Some philosophers claimed that Aristotle had denied the possibility that the human soul is immortal, and they embraced this view. Others broke with this interpretation, preferring the more independent and freewheeling Platonic soul. Thomas clearly accepts the general lines of Aristotle's teaching on the human soul. He insists that the soul benefits from its relation with the body, since only in the body can the soul realize its proper function. Thomas is determined to defend the integrity of the individual human being, body and all. The Platonists exaggerated the spiritual element in man, whereas the Latin followers of some Arabic philosophers subordinated the individual to a collective intelligence. Thomas disagrees with both.
If anyone say that the intellectual soul is not the form of the body, he must explain how it is that this action of understanding is the action of this particular man. For each one is conscious that it is he himself who understands. It is one and the same man who is conscious both that he understands and that he senses. But one cannot sense without a body, and therefore the body must be some part of man.
Thomas says that only with soul and body can the human being fully exercise his natural powers of nutrition, sensation, and perception, imagination and memory, emotion and desire. Only in union with a body can a soul carry out in full measure the intellectual activities of knowing and willing. But this intimate involvement of soul and body was too much for many theologians and devout Christians. Even though the Christian theology of the incarnation and the resurrection emphasizes the importance of the body in human life, Thomas seems to some to veer towards a sort of materialism, a view that reduces the soul to a mere effect of the body. In this view, the soul perishes with the corruption of the body. But Thomas also may be seen as making his own way, taking a step beyond Aristotle without going back to Plato. To Thomas, neither the philosophers nor their opponents are right. The human soul is neither lost in matter nor indifferent to it. In most of its functions, the human soul exercises the primary informing role in the human composite, giving the composite its specifically human nature. But it has its own proper activity as well.
This is the end of part 6. Please download part 7 to continue.